Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Metastatic Breast Cancer. And we offer this program during Breast Cancer Awareness Month in recognition that October 13th is Metastatic Breast Cancer Awareness Day. And we always want to offer this program a few days before to highlight that day for all of you and also to actually present a program on metastatic breast cancer as well. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, both cancer, breast cancer specific and cancer in general cancer organizations as well. And it's because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 920 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Egypt, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit that each of you have chosen to be with us for the next hour on this global call. And today's program was made possible by Pfizer Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Generosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Medical Director, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, Division Head, Hematology and Medical Oncology, the Cooper Health System. She's Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Grana is going to be addressing an overview of metastatic breast cancer, current standard of care, diagnostic testing and technologies, the role of personalized medicine, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Grana.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. In 10 to 15 minutes, I'm going to cover a lot of material just to give you an overview of the topic. First of all, metastatic breast cancer. For the vast majority of you, it's a disease that you've dealt with previously. The majority of women, 85 to 90%, have had treatment for early stage breast cancer, have had surgery, chemotherapy, hormone therapy, or a combination of these, and they then relapse and are diagnosed with metastatic disease. The presentation is usually one based on symptoms or physical exam findings, symptoms such as bone pain, shortness of breath, headache, or some other symptom, and on physical exam, sometimes a nodule, sometimes a lymph node, or such. It's rare for metastatic disease to be diagnosed purely on the basis of scans, and it's for that reason that routine scans in early-stage breast cancer, routine PET scans, CAT scans, bone scans, or tumor markers are not recommended because they rarely give you the diagnosis of metastatic disease. You may have a very negative, clean exam and 2 or 3 months later have metastatic disease. We have to be very clear in our distinction as we talk about this topic today to differentiate local recurrence, regional recurrence, because those are treated differently than women who have distant metastases. A local recurrence is in the breast, in the mastectomy site, or sometimes in the axillary lymph nodes, and that is treated differently. The use of surgery, the use of radiation come into play, very different from the woman who has disease potentially in other organs. Once diagnosed with metastatic disease, prognosis truly depends on where the disease has relapsed. People who have recurrences in skin or lymph nodes do very well. There's data on very long survival in people who have bone-only disease or pleural disease, and they do better than people who have lesions in the lung or liver or even in the brain. So it's important that we know where the disease is so we can get a better sense not only of treatment but also of prognosis. It's also important for prognosis the time that it took to go from the original early breast cancer diagnosis to recurrence. The longer that it takes to get there, the better. So when you hear of women that relapse 9 or 10 years later, those women will actually do a little bit better than the woman who relapses quickly upon completion of her early stage chemotherapy. Prognosis is also dependent on the features of the cancer. When it relapses, we try at all costs to biopsy something of the relapse. And that helps us to, number one, confirm that we're dealing with metastatic breast cancer, because patients can have other diagnoses rather than just metastasis from their breast cancer. It also helps us to define whether the cancer has the same features that it did at the beginning, estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, HER2-new receptor. And in addition, it gives us tissue that we can use when we later talk about precision medicine, personalized medicine, and some of the technology that's out there that can be used to help guide treatment. In about 20% of patients, there's a difference between the pathology as it was originally diagnosed and the reoccurrence. So it's really important that we take that into consideration. Once a cancer has been documented to have reoccurred, what kind of testing, what kind of diagnostic testing do we do? It's important that we assess all sites where disease can be found, and this is where many scans typically are done, CAT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, a bone scan. In some locations, a PET scan will replace the CAT scan and bone scan combination, but we do that because we want to make sure we've looked at all of the potentially affected organs. If a woman has headaches or change in vision, we will image her brain. Labs are important, and here is where tumor markers are routinely done. Not all women have elevated tumor markers when they relapse, but if they do, the markers are actually a nice tool that can be followed to see if the treatment that we're embarking upon is going to help. So tumor markers here are very important. Many people are interested in the concept of circulating tumor cells as a marker both of prognosis from a recurrence and also as a measure of assessing response to treatment. It's still an area of a lot of debate, and I can tell you that many people do not routinely order circulating tumor cells. And then here again, in terms of diagnostic testing, and I'm not quite sure that I would call it diagnostic testing, but here is where I think gene profiling plays a role, and it's the concept of either using Foundation Medicine, Keras, Gene ID, a whole host of them. Some cancer centers have their own in-house profiling facility, but it's the concept that you take a specimen of tissue and you look for alterations in the genetic material of that cancer that can guide you both in terms of potential drugs to use in treatment as well as potential clinical trials that a patient might be eligible for. So again, I don't think of it as diagnostic testing per se, but I think it's important testing. Now let's move on and talk about treatment options and how we select treatment. And again, I'm going to talk about the standard care today. You're going to hear much more about what's being done in a research setting. The treatment options, the selection that a physician and a patient make, has to be based on where the disease is, because that tells us about urgency. How important is it to get a quick response? It has to be based on previous therapy that a patient has had. If a patient has had anthracyclines in the past or taxanes in the past, that has to be taken into account when selecting new therapy. It has to be based on pre-existing toxicity from prior treatment. If a woman has neuropathy, cardiomyopathy, or other symptoms, it's going to guide you in a different direction. And finally, treatment has to be based on estrogen receptor HER2-new status, because those will guide you in selecting different drugs. And we can't forget about the fact that treatment options have to depend on patient wishes. Patients have specific goals that need to be communicated to the clinicians that may make it important that you get treatment every 3 weeks rather than weekly. It may affect whether you go with oral versus IV. There are patients where hair loss is of paramount importance or not. So again, all of those things have to weigh in when a woman is selecting treatment with her team. If a woman has hormone-responsive disease, non-life-threatening hormone-responsive disease, estrogen receptor positive, hormone therapy is the paramount treatment to use. Tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, fulvestrant, and others. And really the question that remains, many questions remain, we don't have all the answers, but Do you use one of these agents alone, or do you use them in combination? Is it important if a woman is premenopausal to render her postmenopausal with either surgery or medication? And how do you combine some of the newer agents with hormonal agents? So, for example, just to give you a sense of this, Arimidex combined with fulvestrant was better in a population of women where tamoxifen had not been used previously. So, again, it's important to know that this may be an option. Lapatinib and letrozole are an option in a woman who's HER2-new positive. Afinitor and dexamethasone for a new combination. And we have a lot of trials that you'll hear about looking at new compounds in combination with hormone therapy. So hormones are my go-to agents for the woman who's got hormone-responsive disease, and you can keep women on one or another hormonal agent often for multiple years before she has to move on to chemotherapy. On the other hand, if a woman has hormone non-responsive disease, the triple-negative breast cancer, or if a woman has extensive disease that is life-threatening, chemotherapy is the mainstay, and we go to that first. There's been a lot of debate as to whether we should use single-agent chemotherapy in sequence or whether we should use combination therapy. And I don't know that we have a definitive answer. ASCO has just said that we might do better with single-agent sequential, but I think it still has to be individualized. The choice of drugs that one picks is based on, again, prior therapy, residual side effects of therapy. It may be based on that precision testing that we talked about, the gene profiling, because that can guide you in terms of selecting some drugs. It may be based on the woman's BRCA1 and 2 status. We know that BRCA1 and 2 cancers may have a predilection for certain drugs. So the message here is that we have lots of drugs, lots of different ways of giving them, agents such as Abraxane, Zolota, Doxil, Halaven, very old combinations such as CMS, newer combinations such as carboplatinum and Gemzar, Zolota, Taxotere, Taxol, Gemzar. Again, lots of options. The only clear thing that we know is that combination therapy, when the physician and a patient choose that route, clearly has more toxicity. And finally, HER2-new positive disease is in a world all of its own. It's a really exciting area because we have some new drugs. Pertuzumab, known as Perjeta, Kadzela, PDM1, are new in addition to neratinib and Herceptin. And many questions remain about how do you combine these agents together, what chemotherapy do you combine them with, but I think it's a very exciting time for HER2-new positive disease. Now, I'm just going to touch base on personalized medicine because, again, the use of these gene profiles can be to help us decide on what drugs to pick, and there's a debate as to whether that's useful or not, but it can help us identify mutations in a cancer that can then be used to put a woman on a clinical trial. So if your cancer has an AKT or PI3 kinase mutation, that'll guide you and your clinician to look for certain clinical trials targeting that. So I think it's a very interesting time for this a profiling technology. Finally, bone-targeted therapy. It's very important if a woman has bone involvement that agents such as Zometa, Xgeva are considered because they've made a very significant difference in the lives of women. They strengthen bone, decrease the complications associated with bone disease such as fractures, high calcium levels, etc. So those drugs become very important. And finally, again, one last caveat is I said that the treatment for a particular woman is a decision that is made between the woman, her family, and her healthcare team. And I believe it's really critically important to have good communication with that healthcare team. They need to know whether you're having pain and where, what your goals of care are, who's in your family and who's going to help you deal with this. They need to understand what your needs are, both psychological as well as physical, so they can hope to meet your needs in the best possible way. I think of this as a diagnosis that affects the family and not just the patient, and it's important to take advantage of all of the services, psychologists, psychiatrists, complementary medicine, meditation, relaxation, etc., because with all of those tools, we can really hope to achieve our best outcome. To finish, there may be some men on this call, and so how often do we deal with metastatic disease in men? It's an uncommon diagnosis. 2,000 cases of male breast cancer each year, and a small percentage of those are metastatic, but they are treated very much the same as female metastatic breast cancers, with the exception that we have less information about the use of hormonals. We know that tamoxifen is very active in men with breast cancer that is ER positive. There's some anecdotal reports about the aromatase inhibitors, but very little else. So again, we do see it, we do treat it aggressively like we treat females with breast cancer. It's just not as common. And with that, I'll stop.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Grana. That was most informative and actually excellent that you talked about the importance of the communication between the woman, her family, and healthcare team. That's really important, and I think that's something perhaps we'll discuss again during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next presenter is Dr. Larissa Corday. Dr. Corday is Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Oncology, the University of Washington. She's Director of Prevention Center Shared Resource, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Associate Member of Public Health Sciences and Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. So that we have Dr. Grana on the East Coast and Dr. Corday on the West Coast. And Dr. Corday is going to address new treatment approaches, clinical trials, treatment side effect management, control of symptoms and pain, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Corday.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here, and I hope that this conference is going to be helpful and informative for all of our participants. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about new treatment approaches and clinical trials. There are many new drugs being tested in clinical trials for metastatic breast cancer, but I would say one theme that's emerging in new trials is taking a little bit of the old with a little bit of the new. And so that is, what I mean by that is combinations of our tried and true therapies, for example, hormonal therapy or chemotherapy, with new targeted agents. And I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail about some of those agents and about some very, very exciting new trial designs. Just to reiterate a little bit of what Dr. Grana said in terms of overall sort of tenets of treatment for metastatic breast cancer, I really think it's important to think about what types of treatments are available to each patient based on the type of tumor they have. And so as Dr. Grana said, you can have endocrine-responsive breast cancer, and that means that hormone therapies will potentially be effective for treatment. For treating those cancers. I think it's important to point out that patients can have tumors that have been biopsied and found to be estrogen receptor positive, but those tumors might not necessarily be hormone responsive. Often that happens over time, so when we first do a biopsy, we see that a patient has a hormone positive tumor, and initially hormone therapies work, but eventually they stop working. And so I think that's one important distinction, and of course the other important distinction is whether patients have HER2 positive disease, because that opens up a whole another line of therapies that are very effective and often less toxic than things like chemotherapy. And so we really want to know if a patient has HER2 positive disease in order to be able to offer him or her those treatments. As Dr. Grana mentioned, we generally do like to do a biopsy at the time of metastatic diagnosis to obviously confirm that metastatic disease is truly present, and then secondly to get a read, a more current read on what the hormone receptor and HER2 status of therapies are. With endocrine responsive disease, as already mentioned, sequential hormonal therapy is often used until progression or resistance to hormone therapy emerges. With HER2 positive cancers, we have a little bit of a different approach, and that is we tend to combine the HER2 targeted agents with some type of therapy, with chemotherapy or sometimes hormone therapy. But the big difference is that the HER2 positive agents will stay on board basically throughout the rest of the lifetime of the tumor. And so even though patients might progress on a regimen of, say, chemotherapy plus a HER2 targeted agent, We may switch to a different targeted agent in combination with a different chemotherapy, but as we go through each line of chemotherapy, we will continue to use some type of HER2-targeted agent in combination with whatever other treatment we're choosing. And that's a little bit different from the treatment of endocrine-responsive disease, where we initially will use hormone therapy, but eventually we'll switch over to using chemotherapy. Now I want to switch over a little bit to talk about some of the exciting things that are in clinical trials currently. Dr. Grana mentioned everolimus that was tested in a number of clinical trials in combination with hormonal therapy and found to be better than hormone therapy alone, and so that is certainly something that has been incorporated into treatment of metastatic cancer for hormone receptor positive disease. That drug is everolimus, also called Afinitor by brand name. Another new drug that I think is extremely exciting that's currently being studied in clinical trials is a drug called palbociclib. That drug is a CDK4/6 inhibitor. It is a CDK is cyclin-dependent kinase. And that drug basically inhibits cell proliferation and DNA synthesis by preventing cell cycle progression. So basically, when cells are dividing, they go through what's called the cell cycle, meaning that's the time during which those cells divide. They replicate and then divide. One cell becomes two. And CDK inhibitors will stop that cell cycle and so not allow those cells to divide. So this particular drug, palbociclib, and there are some other CDK inhibitors earlier along in development as well, was tested first in a phase 1 trial with really, really very outstanding results. Often in phase 1 trials, we don't see much of a signal of whether a drug's working or not, because phase 1 trials tend to be done in patients with sort of very late-stage metastatic cancer who've had multiple other therapies, are less likely to respond, and then also because in phase 1 trials, they are doing what's called dose finding, and so the dose is slowly, slowly escalated to make sure that the drug is safe. So a lot of patients get the drug at a low dose, and you don't necessarily see an effect. So when we see an effect or something that looks like activity in a phase 1 trial, that's generally pretty exciting, and we want to move those drugs forward into phase 2 and 3 trials. In a phase 2 trial that's recently been presented at national meetings, there was the combination of palbociclib and letrozole, or Femara, which is a hormone therapy used for treatment of metastatic breast cancer, in the phase 2 setting. So this was a randomized trial where patients received either letrozole alone or the combination of letrozole and palbociclib, and the progression-free survival, so the amount of time it took for women to have progressive disease, was doubled in the patients that received the palbociclib. So the median progression-free survival was 20 months for women who received the combination versus 10 months for women who received letrozole alone. So I think that's one good example of a drug that is potentially really something on the forefront of what we're going to see in metastatic breast cancer. I want to turn now to talk about some trials in the pipeline that are sort of changing the paradigm of how we do research for metastatic breast cancer, and those are trials that are looking at trying to individualize or personalize therapy for breast cancer. In this series of trials, and I'm giving three examples today, one is LungMap, not a breast cancer trial, but has the same sort of approach in lung cancer. One is NCI Match, which is a what we call a basket trial, or a trial where lots of different diseases and drugs are studied. And then the third is a trial called Aurora, which is being done in Europe. These are all trials in which the tumor undergoes deep sequencing, so very, very detailed analysis of either target genes or of the whole genome. And when abnormalities are identified for which we have good drugs that can target, or for which we have drugs in the research setting that can target, or experimental drugs, patients are then preferentially given those specific drugs or that specific drug to treat their tumor. In the MATCH trial, as I mentioned, that's being run by the NCI, it's all types of tumors, so tumors get sequenced, and then patients with different diseases will receive drugs not based on whether they have breast or lung or bladder cancer, but based on the genetic abnormalities in the cancer. In the Aurora study, which is being done in Europe, that's a breast cancer-only study that includes very robust correlative endpoints, a tumor biopsy is performed on the metastatic disease, gene sequencing is performed, and in this trial, in addition to providing a gateway to standardized agents, this trial is aiming to learn more about tumor responses to standard therapy. So patients are being divided into, for study purposes, patients are being divided into those that are very poor responders and those that are very good responders, and those tumors are being studied to see if we can figure out ahead of time which tumors are going to be good or poor responders. So I think that's something that's extremely exciting in sort of the way that we think about how we do metastatic cancer trials. I'm now going to talk a little bit about management of treatment side effects and control of symptoms and pain. As we've already heard from Dr. Granat, the general philosophy of treatment for metastatic disease is to maximize control of the disease while minimizing side effects. So, for example, for hormone receptor positive disease that's hormone responsive, we want to do the least toxic therapies, such as just oral hormonal therapies, at first and for as long as possible. We can often do, as Dr. Granat said, single-agent sequential chemotherapy rather than, say, doublets, two drugs at a time. But there are cases where we need to do the stronger therapies, for example, cases of rapidly progressive disease, cases where there are severe symptoms or where there's what's called an impending visceral crisis. So, for example, disease in the liver that's starting to affect liver function, disease in the lung that's starting to obstruct the airways, that type of thing. It's really important in terms of managing symptoms and pain that patients take advantage of all the resources that are available to them. So often, in addition to your medical oncologist, many services and many institutions will provide a palliative care service that can be consulted for help in managing pain, a pain management service that can be consulted in terms of helping to manage pain medications. And if pain is present, there are many different additional specialties that can be involved. For example, patients who have pain from a specific bone lesion could be referred to a radiation oncologist, and that lesion could be treated by radiation to manage that pain. At our institution, on our pain management team, we have a pain service that includes pharmacists, nurse practitioners, and physicians who specialize in pain management. And often for complicated cases where we can't just say, oh, let's just use this one drug for pain management, this one pain pill, there is much more to it than that. Involving these other professionals is often very helpful. So lastly, I'd just like to talk a little bit about communication. So as I'm sure Dr. Granat would agree and all of you out there as patients would agree, communication between healthcare providers and communication between the family, the patient, and the primary provider is probably the most important thing about a medical oncology relationship. I tell my patients that are coming for second opinions often that you just need to be comfortable with the physician that's treating you. If you can't ask questions about the therapy, about why they're choosing a particular therapy, about what to expect, then you're losing out a little bit, and you really need to have a physician that can manage your care with you. As part of that discussion, there could be, again, additional providers involved. I have a nurse that works with me, and she knows all my patients very well. And so sometimes patients will bring concerns to her, and she knows to bring them to me, or sometimes she can address them on her own. But having other members of the team involved is very important. In our institution, our infusion services have different nurses than our clinic nurses, and many patients have great relationships with the infusion nurses that they see, and so that person is often involved in the care, letting me know when something's going on with a patient so that I can address it. In terms of open communication, it's really important to talk about goals of care, about fears. Dr. Granat mentioned sometimes people feel very afraid or hesitant about hair loss. And if that's something that's important, then that's something you have to bring up with your physician so that she or he might be able to choose medications that don't cause hair loss. And the last thing I want to just bring up very briefly is the end-of-life discussion. When patients have metastatic breast cancer, patients with metastatic breast cancer will often die eventually of their disease. Our goal is to prolong life and to maintain quality of life for as long as possible, but there does come a point often where we need to talk about end of life. And what I try to tell my patients is that this is a conversation that can be had before you're there, and actually that might be the best way to do it. So oftentimes, when patients are feeling well, they feel, well, I don't need to have this conversation because I'm doing well on my therapy and nothing's going to be happening in the short term. And that's probably true. However, sometimes things can go downhill quickly, and it's really important that your family and that your care provider knows what your wishes are, so that if a situation arises where you're not able to speak for yourself, there are people that can speak for you and can speak basically with your voice, can tell the providers what it is that you would want in that situation. And I think having that discussion earlier is sometimes a little bit easier than having it kind of in the throes of a very acute situation. And I think both patients and caregivers in the end will feel more comfortable knowing that everybody's on the same page about what the patient's wishes are. So sorry to end on that kind of a little bit of a downer note, but I think it's important to be proactive about these things so that if a situation comes up where decisions need to be made, everybody can be on the same page. So I'll stop there and turn things back to Carolyn. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Corday, again, for providing this information to everyone, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Allison Nielsen, and Ms. Nielsen is our Women's Cancers Program Coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. Ms. Nielsen?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's great to be with you on the program today. I'm an oncology social worker, and I work with many women who've been coping with metastatic breast cancer as well as their loved ones. I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're living with metastatic breast cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways in which we can help. First off, I'd like to note that we recognize that women with metastatic breast cancer have unique concerns and needs, and these are often very different from those of women with early stage breast cancer. There are many challenges associated with managing things like ongoing treatment over a long period of time, side effects, quality of life issues, and the uncertainty of the disease. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services for anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally, support groups, also available face-to-face in New York City and over the telephone or online nationwide, education about resources and navigating the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are specifically trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her social network of family and friends. They are experienced in helping people with cancer tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and the psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As I'm sure you're all aware, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. And although it might not always feel this way, when you ask for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling, that's actually a sign of strength. And the good news is that you don't have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about metastatic breast cancer. And individual counseling provides a safe space that is just yours to discuss any concerns. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with metastatic breast cancer experience. And feeling well emotionally, as the doctors have pointed out, can help you deal better with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a support group over the telephone for women coping with metastatic breast cancer. And there's also an online support group for women with metastatic breast cancer where you can openly share your experience. Women in the New York City tri-state area can attend our face-to-face, in-person support groups as well. If you're interested in any of cancer care services, you're welcome to call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE. That's 1-800-813-4673. Or visit our website at cancercare.org. Our comprehensive website is a place to find a lot of additional information on your diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive, as well as other helpful resources. There may be times along the continuum of your care where it's especially helpful to seek out cancer-related supports, such as switching to a new treatment or making a treatment decision, and other times when it makes more sense to focus on normal life outside of the diagnosis. To sum up, as we've learned a lot from today's program, you might need some guidance in digesting it all. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your loved ones. But know that you're not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you through. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison. And thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. And now we do have time for a conversation or questions that you may have for our speakers, and so I'm going to ask Kate to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And because there are so many of you on the call today, if we don't get to your question, please do call Cancer Care at our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number again, and you've received that number from us in the various materials we sent to you. But why don't we go ahead, Kate, and see how many questions we can actually take right now.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And I'm showing we do have a question from the line of Lynn F. Your line is open.
Yes, wonderful presentation, and I appreciate Pfizer for sponsoring it. And was curious, you had such great results with the Palbo phase 1 and phase 2 trials. What is the status of that drug at this point in time?
That inhibitor.
Okay, thanks. My understanding is that it has moved forward to FDA for accelerated approval, and it is in phase 3 trials. Our institution participated in, I believe, one of the phase 3 studies. So there's been studies in the first line, meaning patients with metastatic breast cancer that have not yet been treated in the metastatic setting, where we've already seen data. And then there's additional studies going on in second and third line settings. So I believe for their first line setting, they are in the process of preparing their application to the FDA for accelerated approval. And so hopefully we would hear something within the next 6 months to 1 year.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Catherine C. Your line is open.
Hi. I have a question about follow-up. I've recently had someone with I run breast cancer support groups in Sacramento, including metastatic breast cancer. And some doctors are suggesting there's no need for follow-up treatment. Follow-up scans, blood work, et cetera, with the idea, well, why stress yourself? If it's going to get you, it's going to get you. And I just wanted to know, is that something national or is that just Sacramento?
That's an excellent question. Thank you. And Dr. Grana, could you address that question, please?
So I think what you're alluding to is in early-stage breast cancer, where women with early-stage breast cancer are told that there is no use or value to certain exams. And it doesn't mean no use or value to follow-up, because I think clinical follow-up is very important. Seeing a provider on an ongoing basis is important. Paying attention to signs and symptoms is important. But what is the national recommendation is that there is no value to CAT scans, bone scans, PET scans, tumor markers in women with early stage breast cancer, because none of those things have been shown to lead to earlier diagnosis of metastatic disease or to improve survival. But again, I'm telling my patients, we're not going to do scans, we're not going to do tumor markers, but I am going to see you every 4 to 6 months for the first couple of years, every 6 months until year 5, and then at year 5 often transition to survivorship or to once-a-year visits.
Thank you. Thanks. Our next question, Kate?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
And we also have a question from one of our online participants. And actually, I know it's a question that is on the minds of many people living with metastatic disease. I'm going to ask Dr. Groner if you could address this. If we look at how a cocktail of treatments benefited HIV-AIDS patients, allowing them to live 20, 30 years with their disease with access to treatment, why do researchers, clinicians not consider such an approach for metastatic breast cancer patients? Dr. Groner,
I think that's very much what is being studied and what's being considered. So in HIV-AIDS, we've identified that it's not one drug, but a combination of drugs that leads to suppression of disease and really long-term outcomes are markedly improved. That's where we're going now. Some of the studies are showing that a hormone given in combination with a drug such as everolimus is better than the hormone alone. A hormone given in combination with palbociclib is better than the hormone alone. The problem is we are not there yet. We haven't identified what these cocktails should include. In HER2-positive disease, we now know that giving pertuzumab and trastuzumab, two agents that target the HER2-new pathway, are better than one and provide some ongoing real benefit. So we hopefully will get there, but the problem is we just haven't yet come to identify what the agents that will block the pathways are.
Thank you.
But that's the long-term goal.
Thank you so much. And I think that, Shirley, thank you for asking the question. And Dr. Groner, thank you for confirming that the work is occurring, and that that is the effort here. And so, thank you. And there's another question from one of our online participants: is a biopsy for gene sequencing possible if one has bone mets only? The original breast tumor is gone after AI treatment. Dr. Corday, can you address that?
So a biopsy is often possible of a metastatic site in the bone, and we do often try to do that. The difficulty with it is when we do a biopsy of a metastatic site is to look at estrogen and progesterone receptor and HER2. And the process that a bone biopsy has to go through in order to have that staining done is called decalcification. They have to get rid of the calcium so that they can actually see the cancer cells. And sometimes the decalcification process will result in false negatives in the estrogen, progesterone receptor, and HER2 receptor staining. And so that makes it difficult to do sort of the traditional markers on it. Gene sequencing is done on the cancer cells themselves. And so again, if the cancer cells have been altered in some way by the decalcification process, then that might make it more difficult. With bone biopsies, often we get less cells, so you need a certain number of cells to be able to do gene profiling. So I would say that it's possible, but it's not as straightforward as it is with disease at some other sites.
Thank you very much. And we have a question here about just, in general, just more information on clinical trials for people living with metastatic breast cancer and where they're being conducted. And Dr. Groner, could you address that?
Well, the NCI website is a great location for trial localization, nci.gov, and look at clinical trials. Certain states, and I know New Jersey is one, that has a specific site for clinical trials location within the state. And you also can go to some of the larger cancer centers in your region to see what clinical trials they might have available for you. But I find the NCI site to be very helpful and very easy to navigate. There's always in each trial the investigator's contact information, email address, so it's easy to follow through. Your physician should also be working with you on this. You know, most physicians, your primary oncologist, first of all, when is it the time to pursue a clinical trial? Not when you're successfully being treated and the drugs are working well. You can only participate in a clinical trial if there's disease progression and you're looking to change therapy. So those are the times where you and your clinician should be looking at what are my treatment options and standard of care therapies and what clinical trials may be appropriate to me that are either in my region or that I can travel to. There sometimes are trials that may not be local, but women have resources and support systems that can make that possible. So you should always feel comfortable discussing clinical trials with your primary oncologist and use them as a resource to seek out those trials.
And Ms. Nielsen, in the support groups that you run, is that something that many of the participants are interested in and pursuing? And
absolutely. I do think it's really an area of interest for women with metastatic breast cancer who are interested in not only receiving the newest and most cutting-edge treatment, but also thinking about ways that their experience can contribute to science and contribute to women in the future who are battling this disease. So I'd say that clinical trials come up a lot, and people are always sharing a lot of good information around them.
We have another question from one of our participants online, from Celeste. I know it is very important to watch your diet while dealing with cancer. How much should one avoid white flour and white sugar? I know this comes up a lot, and Dr. Corday, if you could address this issue for our callers on the call today, because it's a question I know that many people often wonder about.
Absolutely. So I get the sugar question often, mostly it's patients coming in saying, so-and-so told me that sugar feeds cancer, and so that I can't eat any sugar because I have cancer. And what I usually tell people is that that's somewhat of an oversimplification in the sense that whatever you eat gets converted into sugar in your body to feed all of your cells. And so there's no way to just kind of in an isolated way starve cancer cells of one nutrient or another when not starving your own and not affect your entire body in the same way. So I generally don't recommend avoidance of specific dietary components. I generally say everything in moderation. I think sugar is okay in moderation. I think flour, unless you have a specific intolerance to gluten or something like that, should be fine. Maintaining a healthy diet is probably pretty important to in terms of making sure that you feel good while you're on cancer care, but specific avoidance of specific dietary components I don't think has ever been shown to affect cancer progression.
And Dr. Bonner, do you want to add to that just in terms of people, perhaps if they have lots of questions, seeing a dietitian in the cancer center?
Yeah, I think that's always helpful. And, a lot of the cancer center dietitians have gone through significant education focusing on all of these issues, supplements, and I have the same recommendation as was stated earlier. I think you have to do things in moderation, a healthy diet, but I don't know that any one particular component in diet is the end-all and be-all of this whole journey. So eat a healthy diet, plenty of exercise, because many women with metastatic disease will have chronic fatigue or other symptoms, and things such as exercise can help with the fatigue and can help with the psyche. So plenty of exercise, plenty of social interactions, meditation, yoga, tai chi, any of those things are phenomenally important, and I focus less on the specific nutrients.
And would you say something about exercise? Because a lot of people, sometimes think what that concept means to people is different for everybody. Would you comment on just what you mean by exercise?
Well, I think it can be as little as walking to people that are doing more rigorous exercise, swimming, weight training, or other activities. And some of it depends a little bit on the woman's disease state. So if you have some bone issues that may be back pain with some bone issues, you need input from your clinician. But by and large, daily walking. I tell my patients, if all you can do is go outside and walk for 20 minutes each day, you've done a tremendous thing in terms of your own muscle strength and your own psyche.
Excellent. Okay, wonderful. And our next question, Kate?
Our next question comes from the line of Jamie D. Your line is open.
Hi. So I have a question kind of a unique perspective in that I work in oncology clinical trials, but I also have metastatic breast cancer. And I've gone up for a number of clinical trials but have been denied because of one eligibility criteria. Before my cancer diagnosis, I've always had a very low white blood count, and kind of it's been determined that I just have a chronic benign neutropenia. But that always hinders me from going on a clinical trial. But I have no symptoms of my disease, and my disease is pretty spread out in a number of different organs. So I have no symptoms. I have no toxicities. I've been on a number of different treatments that have all failed. And so when this comes about, is there anything that can be done to help get on a trial? Because I've consulted with a hematologist, and he really, I don't have a very significant, he calls it a non-impressive infectious disease history, and that I rarely, if ever, get sick. I have no symptoms ever from my, not only my disease, but I have no symptoms or side effects from any of the treatments I've been on. So...
Thank you, Jamie. That's an excellent question. And Dr. Grana, do you want to...
I think it's unfortunate that the trials are as rigid as they are, and I unfortunately don't see a way around this. I agree. You have a condition that is of no threat to you. Cyclic neutropenia or sort of the stable chronic neutropenia is of no concern on an everyday basis, but I think for any trial that is done, the reason they've put in thresholds for counts is because if your counts drop below those thresholds, then you may be at higher risk of infection, and it's not a risk they want to take with you. So I think it's very unfortunate because, as you said, you want to participate in trials, you want to further research, you want to help other women, you want to have access to some of these newer drugs, and you're not going to meet criteria, and I don't see that changing.
Are there other trials that... Jamie could participate in that may not
all
be,
of the trials, unfortunately, all of the trials have, all of the treatment trials, I should say, have criteria that are set by white count, hemoglobin, platelet count as the first liver function studies, renal studies. That's your sort of entry eligibility.
So the quality of life studies, all those other studies.
Yes. No, I think, I think there are many other quality of life things that will be possible, but in terms of treatment studies, drug studies, which is really what she's looking for, I don't see those being an option. Dr. Corday, do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, you know, part of the reason for that is certainly, as you said, you know, there's some fear of studying a drug in somebody who might have a specific side effect. And then the other thing is that when they're doing trials, you know, if a patient develops neutropenia while they're on a drug, then part of the goal of the trial is to assess whether the neutropenia was related to the drug. And it becomes difficult when somebody has a chronic condition like you're describing. And so I agree, it's probably not something that would have a clinical significance, but it is something that probably does keep you out of trials, unfortunately. And I agree that that specifically relates to treatment trials as opposed to other types of trials.
So I'm going to get back. Have the quality of life trials, can you say a little bit about this? Because Jamie may not know as much about those trials, even though they're not drug treatment trials. Do either of you want to comment on those trials?
You know, I see more that there are quality of life components kind of built into some of the treatment trials that we have. Mm-hmm. There are symptom control trials, so there are trials of agents that could be helpful in controlling symptoms, for example, anti-nausea agents or, say, pain management agents. And so I think that that might be something that could be pursued. I don't know of anything specific off the top of my head that would fit in.
So, Jamie, what I would suggest you do is that you would either contact the National Cancer Institute. It's www.cancer.gov. It's in your materials, I think, that you received from us. They also have a toll-free number as well, 1-800, the number 4-CANCER. And they actually, and that's true for everyone on the call, they do have different types of trials that they offer. And you might want to have a conversation with one of their information specialists about other trials that you might be able to participate in. Although I know you're looking for a specific type of trial, nevertheless, there could be some benefit to you of those other trials. And also, Allison, do you want to comment on just this issue in terms of sometimes people wanting to get into a trial? It probably comes up in our groups, and the frustration that people often feel when the trial seems to have a criteria that it's hard for them to get into that trial.
Right. Well, just to say, unfortunately, I do hear some of these stories that for various reasons people are being excluded from trials. As I think Dr. Grana said, they are so restrictive for various reasons, but that can pose a big frustration to patients. So I do think it's a big concern and need, and even though perhaps certain treatment trials are more restrictive in terms of eligibility, as you mentioned, Dr. Messner, there may be other trials that are more conducive to a wide variety of patients.
And that might be something also, Jamie, because it does sound like you're very interested and very committed to this and have a great passion in this area, that I think a vocal also contacting the NCI about this issue is an important voice that I think everyone would appreciate. And so thank you, actually, for bringing this up on the call today, because as much as we're trying very hard to recruit people into trials, there are some very specific criteria that for some people make it difficult to get into them. So all of us working together really makes that big difference. And we have another question from one of our online participants about hand-foot syndrome. And the difficulty of managing that, using thick creams and Aquaphor, but feet are still painful and hands are very dry. Dr. Corday, can you address this particular treatment side effect and anything that you could recommend in addition?
Yeah, absolutely. So hand-foot syndrome is a common side effect with certain breast cancer treatments, including Xeloda, and sometimes with some of the other therapies. In patients that have hand-foot syndrome with Xeloda, basically what I generally do is I will stop temporarily with the drug until the findings have resolved for the most part, and then restart at a lower dose. And I think that with Xeloda, that's probably the best way to go. There are certainly topical things you can do, things like Aquaphor lotion. There's something called Bag Balm, which is pretty good. Utterly Smooth, which is a lotion. We often recommend that our patients actually put a lot of lotion on their hands and feet and then put plastic bags over them to keep some of the moisture in. So that's something that people can try. But really the main thing in terms of management of hand-foot syndrome is going down on the dose of the medication that the patient's on that's causing it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. And I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions on the phone as well as online. And I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning this program, we know that you have many other concerns that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so we encourage you to take advantage of our many services at Cancer Care by calling our counseling line at 1-800-813-HOPE, our HOPE line, where our social workers, our clinical social workers are here to help you. Also, we do include in your materials an evaluation form and very much appreciate your telling us what you think of the program and also what you'd like us to offer going forward. We're planning lots of programs. Indeed, we have many more programs on breast cancer during this month. We do have a program on triple-negative breast cancer in African-American women on October 31st. You've probably gotten those materials, but we encourage you, if you're interested, to listen to that program as well. And we have many other programs as well. So we do very much like to hear your feedback. We appreciate it because it helps us to make these programs most relevant to meet your needs. As we're about to conclude the program today, I don't want any one of you to feel like you're alone in coping with metastatic breast cancer or coping with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're now part of our cancer care community and that we're here to help you. And we are simply a telephone call away or a website away from you. So you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. But that is a very important concern of mine when we conclude the call today, that we don't want anyone to think that, oh, the call's over now, what am I going to do? Please do call us. We are truly here for you. Our services are free, and we know that this workshop may give you some information, but there's many other things that we could be helping you with. So I want to thank you all for your participation today. You've been a remarkable a group, a wonderful team in terms of addressing the issue of living with metastatic breast cancer. And I want to thank you all and wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.